Conversations with Friends is a new series.
A series within a series.
Creative conversations between writer friends.
We were blown away by the calibre of the pitches we received from established, mid-career, debut and emerging writers.
From those writing poetry, fiction, non-fiction, plays, newsletters and PhDs.
Conversations to get you through these strange COVID days and beyond.
Sit back, stay home and enjoy. This episode of Conversations with Friends is with Angus Harvey and McKinley Valentine. Angus Harvey is a political economist and the writer of Future Crunch email newsletter, a weekly roundup of cutting-edge science, mind-blowing technology, and good news stories from around the world that you don't usually hear about in the news.
McKinley Valentine is a newsletter maker and newsletter evangelist. She makes The Whippet, a collection of interesting bits of history and science, personal digressions, and unsolicited advice. She's also an emerging fantasy writer. Her short fiction has been published in Andromeda, Spaceways, In Flight magazine, and Seizure.
Oh my God! This was such an interesting conversation.
This was incredible. And I'm going to admit to my ignorance here. I have read Future Crunch before because wonderful Melbourne writer Else Fitzgerald had recommended it to me, but I didn't get into the habit of reading it. And I still really thought that newsletters were marketing tools. I didn't understand.
It's fascinating. I'm a big fan of newsletters, as you know, and I can never seem to find them. Like, I would love a newsletter that gave a roundup of newsletters, but this is essentially that.
It is.
In addition to some really interesting discussion on its own.
I did sit and then subscribe to everything that they recommended. So my inbox is now going to be completely bursting, but
Check out the show notes, listeners, because these guys sent through, I think, all of the newsletters that they mention, and I too subscribe to every single one.
You know what I think was so important was the idea about developing voice, because I think that that goes across, you know, whatever form you're writing in. And I reckon feedback certainly I got as an emerging writer, and I think emerging writers often get, is this idea that they need to have a stronger voice or develop their voice more. And that idea of just using the regularity of producing a newsletter to develop and strengthen that voice, I loved that.
Yeah, it really is the new blog post, isn't it? Also, just to not do something that is long form, something that's shorter form and regular,
yeah,
is a really good, really good advice.
And don't you reckon, like, I still know writers and just mates who, even on social media, are reluctant to, like, to post because they're not sure about what to post. And what I think they're reluctant about is having this authentic voice and putting it out there. And I think just the practice of it makes that so much better and easier. Like, the more you do it, the better it gets, right?
McKinley talks really well about that, that feeling of post-publish anxiety as soon as you publish a blog post or send a newsletter or whatever it is, that feeling of, oh, crap, really?
Yeah.
But it's like anything, practice makes perfect, doesn't it?
I loved how she said as well, great advice. She was like, don't self-censor, you know, use your voice as strongly as possible. And the people who won't like it, they will self-select out by unsubscribing. I'm like, yes. Like, I'd never thought about it that way before. Just such a nice idea that if they don't like it, they'll unsubscribe. Like, don't try and please them all.
And there's no real consequence to that.
Exactly.
Like, you have less people or different people, that's okay.
Yeah, I love that. So, so very simple.
Nice one. So, listen, this is a really different podcast to the ones.
And they set a goal. They set a goal for the listeners as well. McKinley wants you to start a newsletter. So, I encourage you to do one. Let us know if you do one and we'll shout about it for you.
Good morning, McKinley.
Good morning, Gus. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you. It's great to finally be talking. We've been planning and plotting this session for quite a while.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. We're sort of mutual newsletter admirers, and it's nice to talk in, well, not exactly in person, but nearly in person.
As close to being in person as you can get at the moment. So we're going to be talking about newsletters. And basically the question I'd like to kick off with, maybe, which is something you can help me answer, which is that, is writing a newsletter actually writing?
Right. So when you first, when I first suggested this podcast to you, you wrote back saying something like, oh, but I'm not really a writer. And I was borderline outraged on your behalf, because what do you think makes a writer? Like, you produce a piece of writing every 2 weeks. It's long, it's involved, it's thought through, it's careful. You choose what words to say to deliver the message that you want to deliver. You choose what angle you want to talk to your specific audience. You know, like, what else is there?
I guess the thing about writing a newsletter is that I suppose there's a really strong tension between being a curator and being a writer. And when most people think of what a newsletter is, they think that it's a curation of stuff, maybe a curation of interesting links, or maybe that's at its very best. But at its very worst, a newsletter is basically marketing material that we all get kind of inundated by these horrible newsletters where some company is trying to sell you something. And so a lot of people kind of tune out. That's most people's kind of perception of a newsletter. What's the biggest gap between most people's perceptions of newsletters and what newsletters actually are, in your opinion?
I think people treat newsletters, like you say, as a marketing thing. Like, if a writer has a newsletter, it's a way to tell readers when they have a new book coming out. And I think that newsletters should be treated as a medium in the same way. So with that, you can write nonfiction about climate change, or you can write, one of my favorite newsletters is Jack Fenning, he's a Melbourne writer's Small Town Grievances. And that's like the fictional minutes of a very creepy, very weird town hall meeting. So that's not what people think of when you say a newsletter, but that's because a newsletter is a medium and you can write fiction with it, or whatever it is that would work best in that kind of serialized format. I mean, like, Charles Dickens and all of these old writers wrote in that serialized way. That would be perfect for a newsletter.
So if that's the case, why do people think of news, like, why has that not always been the way that newsletters have worked? Do you think something's changed in the last few years?
I think it's a lot to do with how much Facebook, etc., has broken media. So it's very hard to get people to go to blogs anymore, because people don't sit there and type in, you know, blog.com. They type in Facebook and then there's links out, but there's only one link and they go and they read that post and they don't continue to subscribe to that blog and go back and check it every week and see what's there. Whereas newsletters, it arrives in your inbox and you don't have to think about it.
So I guess what you're saying is that maybe that kind of that energy that used to be in blogging has maybe kind of shifted towards newsletter writing?
I think so. And also, I think one sign is it used to be, so I used to use MailChimp for newsletters, and MailChimp is a marketing platform that writers sometimes sort of hack to use for writing actual content in a newsletter, actual writing. And every, you know, fortnight I would get a notification from MailChimp being like, you made $0 in revenue off this newsletter. And I was like, yeah, I know, I wasn't trying to sell anything. But now there's platforms like Substack, which are designed for writers. They're not meant to be just a sales funnel to sneak people in to buy your product or whatever. They're meant to just communicate the writing that you want to share with people.
I suppose that kind of comes back to that original kind of thought that I had, though, which is that, you know, writing a newsletter doesn't necessarily feel like being a writer. And I suppose it's because when I think about being a writer, this idea of being a writer, it's kind of tied up almost with like a romantic view of what being a writer is, which is someone who's kind of huddled in a dark room, you know, furiously pouring out manuscripts, and who, you know, thinks and breathes writing all the time. They're kind of, they go to the writers' workshops and they have a writing group that they meet with twice a week, and they have an MFA, and, you know, it's kind of, it's this person who is just who lives and breathes writing as a lifestyle. And I guess that to me is what being a writer actually is. It's someone who has published something or who has a book. But I suppose what you're saying with newsletter writing, the kind of range of voices and people who are writing, it's way more eclectic. And for a lot of people, that's not necessarily their main practice. It's not necessarily their main source of income, writing.
No, but I mean, if you think that published book writers' main source of writing is book writing, then like that's a bit of a myth. I think the average income for a writer in Australia is $11,000 a year. So that's no one's, it's a few people's main job. It's Tim Winton's main job.
Okay.
Most other people, you know, they would love to spend literally all of their time living and breathing writing, but that's unrealistic for most writers. And the idea that I understand why you want to keep, or you have an idea that newsletters are separate from, say, fiction writing, but the myth that you have to be writing full time to be a real writer, or that you need to have a writing community. It's nice to have a writing community, but that's not available to everyone. And those people shouldn't feel like they're not real writers because they don't have it.
Mm. I really like that. I feel like that's, there's something really freeing about that, which is that in order to be a writer, not all your income has to come from writing.
God, no.
That's amazing.
There's like three writers left. Even the full-time writers who, you know, do make money from writing, most of them are still making a lot of it from running workshops or speaking or, you know, sort of tangential connected things.
Can I tell you how I discovered your newsletter?
Yes, please.
So I am actually friends with Honor Eastley.
Aha.
For anyone who's listening, Honor Eastley runs something called the Big Feels Club. She's a fantastic advocate for mental health in Australia. And about a year after we became friends, she just kind of casually mentioned, she said, oh, you know, you have to subscribe to this newsletter by someone called McKinley Valentine. And I loved it straight away. I guess the thing that I love about your newsletter is the voice is just so distinctive. And I think this is what actually makes really great newsletters, because the newsletters that most people think, when most people think of newsletters, they think of the kind of email marketing newsletters, and the voice is always kind of corporate legalese marketing speak, and it's just so bland.
Yeah, or kind of peppy corporate, where it's very corporate, but they're also like, buy our stuff, you'll love it. Man. And you're like, eh.
And it's just, it's soul deadening. Mm. Whereas I think, you know, your newsletter and all the newsletters that I really enjoy, they all have such a distinct voice.
So
even
I think
it's just in curating links. And so that was what attracted me straight away on yours.
I think that is absolutely the strongest, what makes newsletters a medium in themselves is that they are tied together so strongly by voice, because you're often, when you have a blog, they were like, you've got to find your niche. You've got to write about, you know, sewing for teens or something really, really specific. And in newsletters, they tend to be a lot more eclectic, which I think works well for writers because writers are magpies. They don't necessarily stick to one niche or one idea. But the thing that runs through it is that it's the same voice every time. And I have found writing The Whippet, which is my newsletter, really, really great for developing my voice. When I first started, and when I look back at the first issues, they're written in a much more dry way. I was almost using the links that I share, which is sort of about a quarter of the newsletter or something, and the rest is my writing, as a vehicle where I could say, it doesn't matter if my writing's bad because I'm sharing something else that's good. And as I got more confident, I leaned more into, it's not exactly my natural voice, but it's like an exaggeration of my natural voice, with sort of a lot of enthusiasm and maybe whimsy, or I don't know quite what the word is. And I think that I would recommend for anyone who doesn't feel confident in their voice that a newsletter is a really good way to develop it, because the more that I wrote and the more that people didn't unsubscribe the second I put any personality into it, the more I was like, okay, this is okay to speak like this. People like it. And I think I've leaned more and more heavily into that voice.
What else can I say about voice? The other nice thing I think about having the newsletter is you can try out different voices. So
yeah.
I think I remember in the early days when we first started out the newsletter, we had this kind of voice that was quite kind of peppy and upbeat, and the voice was sort of, look how amazing the world is. You know, we shouldn't all be all doom and gloom. More recently, that's kind of evolved to be a bit more of a combination maybe of outrage and optimism together, or what we call O2, which is like oxygen, which is that we wanted to kind of, we wanted to acknowledge, it helped to, and I suppose that also comes with the evolution of our own attitudes towards the world. My partner and I, Tane Hunter, who I run Future Crunch with, we started Future Crunch back in 2014, and the newsletter I started in 2015. And the world's changed quite a lot since 2015. And I've changed quite a lot since 2015. And so it's been really interesting watching the newsletter evolve with my own attitudes towards the world.
Mm. One of the things that I've really noticed about my own newsletter is that in terms of that change, one of the big things that happened to me midway through the newsletter is I was diagnosed with ADHD. And when I look back at old newsletters, it is so, so, so obviously to me written by someone who has ADHD. Like, there's so much that I mentioned that I'm just like, everyone must have known, or did they? I don't know. Maybe it only becomes clear to you once you have an understanding of what that sort of brain looks like. But the thing about how I have very, very exciting things that I research obsessively and then lose all interest in a week later, as well as I have a section in the Whippet called Unsolicited Advice, which is basically, I was never great at picking up on social norms naturally. And so I learn them manually, and I watch and I read things, and then I figure out kind of a rule. And this is just really, really textbook neurodiverse kind of way to do things. So I write what I found in Unsolicited Advice. And I found that people, including neurotypical people, have found it really, really helpful. So I kind of think everyone should codify what they learn in that way, but I'm probably projecting.
So this is one of my favorite bits about the Whippet, the Unsolicited Advice part. And that's really interesting. I had no idea that that was the genesis for the Unsolicited Advice column. I always thought Unsolicited Advice was there because you just really liked advice columns on the internet or in newspapers, and this was kind of your own way of getting your own advice column up and running. And I always thought that made sense, because to me, I actually think that advice columns are one of the most underappreciated genres of writing in existence.
Some of them are, Dear Sugar is an advice column, and it's just breathtakingly beautiful literary, you know. Yeah.
Anyway. I think it was by Cheryl
Strong Voice. Strade. Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. Incredible writing. And so for me, when I see your unsolicited advice column in the Whippet, I say, well, of course there should be an unsolicited advice column. I mean, it's one of the great underappreciated genres of writing, and McKinley must intuitively understand that. But it turns out that it's actually just your manual for decoding humans.
It's a bit of both. I do love advice columns, and I think that it's also a way to talk about the ways in which you fuck up yourself. And I think it's kind of important to do that, because sometimes I can be a bit preachy, I guess. And I think it's really important to also, anytime you're preaching, you should be able to show the ways in which you make mistakes as well. And so unsolicited advice is sort of often, here's stories of the ways in which I have messed up and how I've learned not to do that anymore. The original unsolicited advice column came because a family member gives almost nonstop unsolicited advice. And I wrote this long, basically rant about why you shouldn't give unsolicited advice and how to handle that. Like, when people want to give unsolicited advice, it usually means something like, I care about you and you want to help. So I'm like, just say, I care about you and you want to help. Don't give the unsolicited. Anyway, I'm going on that rant again. So calling it unsolicited advice is kind of me being self-deprecating about being a bit of a hypocrite. About that.
It's great. It's one of my favorite parts of your newsletter. The other thing that I really love about the Whippet is that you just seem to be obsessed with animals.
It's that animals are so weird. It's not really deliberate. It's that anytime I learn anything that makes me go, oh my God, that's so weird, I've got to tell someone. And a lot of time that's an animal. Animals are bizarre. Even the animals you think are normal, you look them up on Wikipedia and they will have something bizarre going on.
Nice thing about animals is that they're not part of the latest flame war on Twitter.
Yes, typically not. One day I'll be wrong and they will be. But I guess there was that when Bird of the Year was going in the Guardian columns and people got pretty, pretty head up about it. And some people were rigging the vote and things like that. So I suppose that's a time to step out of cool animal facts. I want to talk about positivity. Because you said that Future Crunch started with more pure positivity. And in the Whippet, part of the no hot take cycle is I also try not to talk about just deeply depressing stuff. You know, I like to talk about history and philosophy and ways in which I personally have fucked up, and all of these things are not necessarily joyful, but I don't like to talk about just like, oh, you know, another woman was murdered this week in Australia or things like that. Not because they're not important, but because I want there to be a place where people don't need to think about that for 5 minutes. And you also have this positivity approach in Future Crunch. But how do you handle, if there's been times when me not talking about the news cycle has felt almost egregious, like when the bushfires were on or with the Black Lives Matter protests. And I did actually write a bit about that, but just briefly. Do you sometimes feel like you're misrepresenting things by being too positive?
The answer to that is 100% yes.
Yeah, okay.
But it's also, this idea is at the core of Future Crunch. It was actually the genesis of Future Crunch itself. The idea that we needed more stories of change, of positive change. And it came from taking a long, hard look at the media sphere and what is quite obvious, and which has been what's been obvious not just for a few years, but it's been obvious to most people for decades, is that the news or the news media reports overwhelmingly on bad news. This is a truism which all people accept, and yet not many people seem to do much about. It's one of these really weird, it's a strange fact of modern life, which is that almost anyone you ask will tell you that they understand that the news gives us overwhelmingly bad news, and that the media reports on the bad stuff and not on the good stuff, but no one really does anything to change that or to change their consumption habits on media or to try and kind of bring some kind of semblance of balance back into reporting. Every now and again, periodically, you'll get kind of some kind of flurry where people will create a good news newspaper or put some section on a website which says, oh, now for some good news. And you also see it in media reporting itself. You know, at the end of a sort of 12-minute bulletin of horror and fire and disaster, at the end they go, and now, and finally, here's a lovely story where a bird has been rescued from a tree in Queensland. And it just, that just seems so out of whack and so out of balance that we thought, there must be room here for an outlet that can report on all the amazing good news stories that are happening all around the world, big stories of human progress without.
Yeah, I like that, Future Crunch, like when you talk about good news, it's not a bird has been rescued from a tree. Not that those aren't nice stories, but they're emotion porn. They're not really something that when you're like, the whole world is on fire, but look at this cute cat. That's like, it's not really balancing it.
No, it makes it worse. It actually makes it feel worse because they say, here's all this terrible stuff that's happening and here's this one tiny example of something good, which is the only good thing that we could possibly find. Mm. Future Crunch was born from a desire to change that narrative. And so what we did was we started researching stories of positive change and everything from global health to big environmental wins. We report on stories of changing legislation for human rights, you know, human rights victories on women's rights or children's rights in different parts of the world, legislation to enshrine rights for disadvantaged communities, big changes on, increased democratic governance, all the big scale stuff that just doesn't seem to get reported. That was very important for us to report on. But what we found was that, as you said, the newsletter only includes those stories. We don't report on all the bad news stories because everyone can find a thousand examples of those in every other media sphere that they look. And the principle that we use in order to kind of get around this guilt or worry that we're not reporting accurately, which is that in order to bring balance back into media reporting, we need to be wildly unbalanced. Because even if we are the only outlet that only reports good news, we're still one outlet out of 1,000. And so there's no point in us reporting 50-50, because that's just going to dilute the message anyway. So we deliberately make the decision to report only good news in our newsletter because it provides at least one counterbalance against the overwhelming narrative of doom that just seems to come out perpetually from media.
Sure. One thing I really want to say, because my covert goal in this is I think that anyone listening should start a newsletter, is that we're both talking, we both have nonfiction newsletters. Mine is a little more, I guess, borderline creative nonfiction in some places, but that a newsletter is a medium and, like you say, you can do anything with it. And I hope that you will consider starting one and that you won't base it on what Future Crunch and The Whippet are, but just what do you write? What do you like to write? What voice would you like to develop? What would you like to get more practice in? Having a newsletter, for me, having a two-weekly schedule, I started it partly because I had stopped writing and I loved writing and I was so sad that I stopped writing, but I couldn't get back into it. So I set myself a deadline, and that deadline is purely self-imposed. There's no one other than readers who, and at the start there weren't even readers who expect The Whippet to come out every second Thursday, but I told myself that it was a non-negotiable deadline, and when I have to, I stay up till 5 a.m., you know, the night before, so that it always goes out. And applying that level of discipline has been so valuable to me. So if you struggle with regular writing practice, a newsletter gives you the structure to force you to do it. And I would recommend that so strongly.
So that, I think, is just such fantastic advice. I have something similar, but before I kind of comment on that, I just want to ask, if you were going to give advice to anyone who wants to start out a newsletter, what advice would you give them apart from sticking to a regular schedule? You know, what do you know now about writing newsletters that you wish you'd known when you started?
I would say be yourself as much as possible. No, that's not right. Develop your own voice. Use your voice as strongly as possible. Don't pull back on voice because you're worried that people won't like it. Some people won't, but they will self-select out and they will unsubscribe. One of the good things about a newsletter is that if you suffer from imposter syndrome, where you're like, who am I? What do I have to say? Who am I to like expect people to read my writing? You're not expecting anyone because they can unsubscribe. And if they haven't unsubscribed, then they wanted to read it. And so you don't need to feel arrogant about it. That personally was a huge help to me. I think it's also useful to set parameters. So for me, that no hot takes was a parameter, or a structure, because it's always easier to write within certain structures. So I always know, okay, I have to have a certain amount of interesting facts. I have to have unsolicited advice. And that makes it much easier when it comes to write it, because I have these separate sections.
The best piece of advice that was ever given to, well, the reason I actually started the Future Crunch newsletter was something that I heard in an interview with a guy called Derek Sivers, who's a venture capitalist from Silicon Valley. And it was just, you know, you sometimes hear a little phrase or a little something that just kind of blows your mind open. This was back in 2015. And he said, it's not what you know, it's what you do consistently that counts.
Okay.
And I'm just going to say it again because it was so mind-blowing to me at the time and still is mind-blowing to me today, which is that it's not what you know, it's what you do consistently that counts. And to me, what that said was that I've got all this stuff in my head and I've got all these things that I want to say or do in the world. I've got all these opinions or views, but if I don't get them out consistently, then no one's ever going to know what's inside my head.
Sure. Okay.
And the consistency also means that people can trust me as a voice. So if I'm not showing up every fortnight to write this newsletter and I don't do that on a consistent basis for years, then no one's going to trust me that I'm committed enough to this thing that I should be someone who's worth listening to. Because why listen to someone if they're just going to do this thing and then it's just going to be a fad that they're going to get bored of and move on again from? So really that commitment to being consistent about the delivery of the newsletter, which is what you talked about, and I do exactly the same thing. I stay up till 5 a.m. if I have to get the newsletter out. That has been the most transformative practice of anything that I know, because it means that, and we all know this as writers, my writing has improved exponentially in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, I write every 2 weeks and I've forced myself to write every 2 weeks for 5 years. That has been incredible. But also it's allowed me to build out content and find new avenues for the business that we run and for who I am on the internet that I would never have even imagined were possible when I set out to do it in 2015.
There are newsletters that I subscribe to. One is Leah Ginnivan. She's a doctor resident, something in the top end in the far Northern Territory and in remote areas. And she talks about being a doctor in remote areas and the challenges of that. And her newsletter comes out maybe every 2 months, but every time I'm so glad to see it. So I think a commitment is necessary, a non-negotiable commitment, but it doesn't have to be as regular as we make it. So long as it is something that you don't just let fade into nothing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it can be once a month. It can be once every 2 months. I agree with that. So which newsletters do you like? Because I subscribe to Leah Ginnivan's newsletter as well, and it's fantastic. I think she had the best description of Darwin after rain that I've ever seen.
It reminded me of the Poisonwood Bible, which is a fantastic book. And it was so similar to that in not the same writing, but the same feeling of lushness and heat and... I don't know. It was an incredible piece of writing.
Yeah. What else? I've got a bunch that I have. But what newsletters do you love, and which newsletters do you think people should subscribe to?
I'm a huge fan also of Jack Drews's newsletter. He's a Melbourne comedian, and it started out, I think, as a way for him to just sort of try out jokes before he went on the stage. But it has evolved into this. It's almost like the best self-help book you've read, where it's really, really thoughtful, insightful, considered, self-aware exploration of ideas, and especially ideas and creating art, even though I'm not a stand-up comedian, but I have similar thoughts about what does success look like. You know, he, for him, is that success at the Melbourne Comedy Festival, or is success writing a piece of work that you feel really good about? And that applies to any creator, whether it's external or internal. So Jack Drews, isn't it? Every single issue comes out. I want to force other people to read it, but I've stopped doing that because I've recommended it already about a billion times, but it's amazing.
I have this one newsletter that I subscribe to. She's a writer from the American South. Her name is Autumn Christian.
Okay.
She's like the biggest cliche of... She's like everything that you can imagine a goth is. She is that. And yet she writes the most beautiful, kind of dense, dark, kind of goth stuff. And this kind of writing really pleases my teenage soul.
Yep.
So that's kind of one guilty pleasure that I have. And then the other newsletter that I really love is by someone called Sarah Jaffe.
Okay.
Who is a labor activist in the United States. And it's a wonderful example of how you can kind of conduct activism through a newsletter. She always links to some really great kind of resources, and she's got a wonderful kind of writer's voice in her newsletter as well. Those are just two that come to the top of my mind. There are a ton of others. And again, we'll put those into the show notes. So I want to talk about getting paid.
Oh, okay.
Now, what's been interesting is in the last year or two, there's been this kind of wave of people moving across to newsletter platforms like Substack, but also Patreon, I suppose, which has been going a lot longer. And it's this idea around, I think, what I've seen referred to as the passion economy, which is the idea that you can make a living online through a community of not necessarily even just 1,000 true fans, but something as small as 100 true fans,
mm-hmm.
People who will pay for your work. Is getting paid for your newsletter work something that you think about? And if not, then what role does the newsletter have in your kind of wider commercial setup in terms of how you get paid or make a living?
I have a Patreon, and I get at the moment close to $300 Australian dollars a week, a month, but I also put almost no effort into Patreon. I don't offer special rewards. I don't really have behind the scenes content or anything like that. It's just a link at the bottom of the newsletter that says, if you want to give me some money, I'd love it, basically. And people do. And that is incredible and beautiful to me. People literally are just, I'm getting this for free, but I want to help out. And I think that is really nice to know that as soon as you open up the doors for people to pay artists, people want to pay artists, even when they're not getting anything extra about it. They like to be involved with the work that artists do. I think that's really, something nice. It does make a difference to my feeling that there is a point in doing this, that I'm not being too financially stupid by spending the amount of time on it that I do. And it also pays for me to be able to be patrons of other people, which I appreciate. I think that the connections that I've made through having a newsletter have been big. It's almost like the equivalent of a business card that people actually like and keep re-looking at every fortnight. It's a way to say, hey, I met you, you're cool. You know, if you want to hear what I'm saying, here's my newsletter.
Have you ever garnered any work through the Whippet? Has anyone ever contacted you and said, hey, I love your writing, I'd like you to do some work for me?
Yeah, so I actually do two other newsletters now that are paid for. So I do the newsletter for Paper Giant, that is a design studio where I collect and edit the writing of people in the studio. So it gives them a platform to think about design and to write about it. And to, again, it's that thing of a deadline. All of them want to do more writing. All of them want to write about their practice, but now they have, okay, well, you have 2 weeks to do it and you have a deadline and it's going to be edited and it's going to look good when it comes out. And then I also do the newsletter for a board game company, Jelly Bean Games, where this has just started, where they have a range of board games and I will take one board game and use that as a theme. And, you know, one of them's called Dracula's Feast. So I can be like, okay, here's a bunch of Dracula-related, vampire-related lore. So that works all come directly out of people saying, I like the Whippet, can you do that for us? And also just some editing and writing work that's come through, not directly through the Whippet, but through, so it's people I already knew in real life, but it was people I knew in real life who are now like, oh, you can do this, you can write. Okay, well, we need someone who can do that.
Great. I love that idea that it's kind of the ultimate business card. That is a wonderful way of actually, that is one of the best descriptions of a newsletter I think I've ever heard.
You, as far as I know, get quite a lot of money through Patreon for Future Crunch, but it all goes to charities.
That's right. We, I think about 2.5 years ago, we decided that it wasn't enough to talk about positive change, that we actually wanted to be part of positive change. It started feeling ethically inconsistent to be reporting on all the other good things that people were doing, but not actually putting our money where our mouth was.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know whether this is actually true or not, but that's just how it felt for us. Mm-hmm. So we decided to open up a Patreon, and we now get about $3,500 Australian dollars a month.
On that Patreon. So much money. I want that much money. Sorry, no, it's good that it's going to charity. That's a good thing.
And we give all that away to charity.
Yep.
So we find small little charities that are using science and technology to do something amazing. And again, it kind of fits in with that idea of, you know, people who are doing amazing stuff, but they're buried beneath the noise.
Yeah.
So we always try to find really small charities. We've helped charities everywhere from Zimbabwe to Papua New Guinea to Kenya. We've helped charities in Peru. We try to cast our net across the entire world. And of course, the money goes a lot further in those kinds of countries than it does.
Sure.
In our own backyards.
Those US dollars on Patreon. That's the good stuff.
Yeah. And that's been wonderful. Again, it signals to our community that we're serious about what we do. And it creates a sense of purpose to writing the newsletter that I'm not sure was there before.
Yeah.
We are, however, thinking of changing that model eventually to see if we can make the newsletter more sustainable on its own. Mm-hmm. Because the way we make a living is from speaking and presenting at conferences. And that,
no conferences right now.
And our job is illegal right now. So
yeah.
so we have been thinking and strategizing a lot about how we can retain this kind of charity model, but still earn some kind of income from writing the newsletter. And that is something that's very much in the works. And what's so exciting about that is that the platforms like Substack and others now exist to be able to actually do that. And that hasn't really been possible in the, except for the last year or two.
This is just an absolute segue, but it's more in my mission to convince other people to start newsletters about some other benefits that it's had to me. Often when I've created something, I just get this like wave of shame afterwards where I'm just like embarrassed that it exists and afraid and, you know, it's clearly some kind of emotional thing that going is, on that, that is, I should see a psychologist.
No, that is normal. I experience exactly the same thing every time I produce a piece of content.
And, that actually and I'm makes too me ashamed feel a lot
to look at it. And then I go back a year later and I'm like, oh, that wasn't actually that bad.
So what's happened to me with putting something out regularly is that, you know, it's been, I think, 3.5 years now, is every 2 weeks I have this horrific reaction of revulsion and shame. And I message my partner and I say, oh God, I think this is a really bad issue. But because I have to get it out, if it's done, I post it. It's not possible for me to say, well, this isn't good enough, so I'm not going to put it out into the world, because I have to put something out because I've agreed that I will. And then the next day someone emails me and says, this was my favorite issue. Or even just my partner kindly messages me and says, no, it was fine. This one's good. You're good. And you know, even if it was a flat issue, which I'm sure it is sometimes, because of course it is, no one calls me up and yells at me about it. You know, they probably just go, eh, not the best, and move on with their life. And that continued experience of feeling that shame every Thursday morning on the regular, and there being no bad consequences for it, and occasionally good consequences, has kind of exposure therapied me into realizing, firstly, in reducing that shame a bit, but mainly into realizing that that shame reaction just is not very meaningful. So now when I write fiction, which I'm not as strong a writer at, but I do want to improve at, and I have that same reaction, I can sort of go, yeah, but you always feel this way. It doesn't mean the work is bad. It's just some brain response that happens. Mm-hmm. So I think that having that forced deadline and has helped a lot with that emotional response. So if you also have that emotional response, I recommend it.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know why the emotional response exists. I don't know what purpose it serves, but it very much exists for me. And I think there's another thing that comes, and this comes back to that consistency and that commitment that you make to yourself in getting a newsletter out, which is that in the 2 weeks in the lead up to the newsletter, I'm kind of walking through the world with a tiny little portion of my brain ticking over and saying, what am I going to write about next?
Yeah, it changes how you see the world, I think.
It does. And it also changes how I read the internet, because it now means that I'm reading the internet with a kind of a lens of saying, what can I say that's interesting about what's happening in the world right now? And so it's a lens by which to navigate not just the internet, but by which to navigate my daily life. And it means that I've always got a tiny little project going on in the back. And I find that quite fun.
I'm much less likely to click on these kind of outrage, clickbait, horrible news stories, because I know that I'm not going to be able to write about it. I'm not going to be able to do anything about it. And so if I have this feeling of outrage, I don't have an outlet to express that other than, you know, the usual venting. And so that helps me read better than I would otherwise. Although that lens also means that sometimes I will be midway through a conversation with a friend, say something, and then be like, stop, what I just said is really interesting. I'm writing it down, which is incredibly arrogant, but you know.
I think it's great. I think it's just a commitment to the writerly craft. The other thing that I think you talked about, kind of exposure therapy. For me, the therapy of writing the newsletter is that once every 2 weeks, I have to go and research all of the good news stories in the world.
Sure.
And that is fantastic therapy for someone who comes from a sort of environmentalist background and who until 5 or 6 years ago kind of believed that the world was doomed. I don't believe that anymore. And the reason I don't believe that anymore is because I've shocked myself through exposure therapy to just an overwhelming torrent of incredibly good news, to the point where I now believe that we might actually all be okay.
That's a nice thing to believe. I'm not sure where I stand on that. I think I try not to think about it, about the literal, are we doomed or not? For me, one of the big sort of things is that because I fact check everything that I put in, every time I fact check something, I learn something new about the original item that I was looking up. And so it's left me with this worldview that if you scratch the surface of anything, it's going to be more interesting than you thought. And that is a good brain to end up with.
Great. Final question for you from me. What has surprised you most about being a newsletter writer?
I don't know if I have an answer for that. What I've liked most about it is probably the building connections with other writers including not just newsletter writers, but when other people see that you're making something, that creates a different sort of connection than when you're just a fan, even if you're working in completely different fields. That's been really nice. What surprised you most about being a newsletter writer?
It may be that it forced me to become a writer.
Sure.
I mean, I still have imposter syndrome, but I think I'm a lot closer to living and breathing the desire that I've had since as long as I can remember, since I was a small boy, to actually be a writer. And I think that the newsletter was my unconscious commitment device to myself to actually get myself a bit closer to that. And I think I'm a lot closer now to finally becoming the person that I always wanted to become than I was 5 years ago when I started the newsletter. And it's directly thanks to the newsletter that I can say that.
That's really nice. I think that that's true of me. I remember we had some school assignment in grade 5 to paint yourself as your future career. And I remember the painting that I had of myself as a writer with red hair, because I believed that all the cool adults dyed their hair red, which I don't know where I got that idea, but anyway. And I still want to publish a book. I still want to write fiction. I've had a few short stories published and I'm writing again, fiction again now. And that's become easier through the discipline that I've learned through the newsletter. You were talking about that idea about the start, about your idea of the writer's life and being living and breathing the writing community. And you said that you're not like that. And then you listed all of these newsletters that you read with, and they're not just curations of links, with these, you know, gorgeous and lush writing styles. You are part of a community. That is a community where you write something and you read other people who are writing the same sort of thing, and you talk to each other about it and you try to get better at it. I don't know what.
I think for me, the writing community has always been people who sort of hang out at galleries and drink red wine and talk about very serious things.
Yeah. I know what you mean. And I do. Look, I'd like to spend more time at coffee shops, but I'm also a massive introvert. And whenever anyone actually invites me, I'm just like, oh, maybe next time. No, I shouldn't say that. I go to writers' workshops. I read a lot of how to write guides. I listen to podcasts like this. I think the idea that community has to be face-to-face is a fake idea that I should hope that writing newsletters kind of disabuses you of a little. Mm. Gus, so if someone wants to subscribe to Future Crunch, where do they go?
So Future Crunch, they just need to Google Future Crunch. That we should be the first thing that comes up. We're lucky nobody else has got our name. And there's a big button on the right hand side that says subscribe, and they just need to click on that, and that will take them through to the Substack platform where they can subscribe for free.
Excellent. I have terrible SEO, and I also chose the name The Whippet. So what comes up if you Google The Whippet is a bunch of whippets, which is nice. So you would need to go to thewhippet.org, and there you can see some back issues and subscribe links. I also have a page on that site of other newsletters that I recommend with a little blurb about them.
Great. In the show notes as well, we will include a number of the newsletters and resources that we have both found really helpful.
Yeah. And again, I would say, please start a newsletter and don't be limited by what other people have been done. It's a medium. Use it to write the kind of writing that you want to write.
And the last thing is, I want to thank you, McKinley, for your newsletter. It's one of the very few newsletters which gives me a tiny little jolt of happiness every time it lands in my inbox.
Thank you so much.
I always learn something new. It's the highest form of it's the best high quality esoterica that I know of anywhere on the internet. And I really appreciate you writing it. And I'm looking forward to many more editions to come. So thank you.
Thank you. There's a line from Lord of the Rings, which is something like the praise of the praiseworthy is above rubies or something like that. So thank you. I really should have that memorized better. I have a lot of Lord of the Rings quotes memorized. Anyway, thank you also for Future Crunch. I like to think I'm pretty on the pulse of things, but I always learn, as you say, I always learn something new. And particularly the global stuff, it's really hard to get away from information that isn't US, UK, AU. And I really like finding out about what's going on in the wider world.
Right. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.
This series is supported by the City of Melbourne through a COVID-19 arts grant.